Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN. Thanks very much for staying up late with us, everybody. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio here on Wacker Drive. Joining us on the phone right now is our aviation analyst expert who's been a good friend of the show over the years, and you see him on CNN all the time. You know his website, whyplanescrash.com, and it was already, I believe, almost 4 years ago that we talked about his book, Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, Why It Disappeared and Why It's Only a Matter of Time Before This Happens Again. Here we are, 5 years and a day later. Good morning, David Soucy. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it, as always. Roger and I were talking about this at the beginning of the show. If somebody would have said to me a day or two ago, Flight 370, when did that happen again? I would very easily say a couple of years ago. It's amazing that it is actually 5 years ago. Does that surprise you looking back at this? Because you've done so much work with this. You were with the book so long ago now. Can you believe we're already 5 years out from that?
No, I couldn't believe it either. Somebody else said that to me this morning, and that it was only 3 years. And no, it's five. It's been 5 years. A lot of good things have happened since then, and there's a lot of things that they haven't done yet, still, after 5 years.
I would imagine. I have an article here from CNN.com that CNN had out about new tech that's come out since 370, and it says, starting next month, a new satellite system will allow controllers to track planes in real time anywhere they go. Is this something that's actually going to, because in your book, you know, one of the titles of your book is It's Only a Matter of Time Before This Happens Again. Is there new technology now that maybe is taking that part of it out? Could this happen again?
Yeah, unfortunately it can. There actually was technology at the time that could have done that, but no one used it because it was expensive. This new system that's coming out now, it's still expensive. It still costs money. The biggest challenge, though, is that there's no regulatory body in the international aviation community that's going to say, you have to do this. It's something that's still optional for every carrier from every country around the world.
Okay. Because I remember at the time, right, that there was a different package, you know, because these pings that we all heard so much about at the time that were checking in, that's like the most basic thing that I believe all of the airlines, right, these pings happen and they would have a record of that. But there was, if Malaysia Airlines and other airlines had been willing to spend more money on the tracking systems, the planes would have been in touch with some satellite at all times, correct? Even five years ago.
They would. Even 5 years ago, it was more expensive then. You know, as things go by, the technology becomes more and more affordable as you go on. You know, laptop computers used to pay $3,000 or $4,000 for them. You know, now you can pick them up for a couple hundred bucks here and there. So that happens over time, and that's the same case here. But we're still talking about what seems like pennies to each of us as flyers, or hundreds of millions of dollars to airlines. It could be 15, 20 cents a ticket for us, but for them, it's still a major investment for those airlines to buy the equipment.
And in a weird way, David, has the fact that we're 5 years out, and there isn't truly an international outcry about this. There was a huge surge at the time, but I would imagine that for airlines that are being told, okay, you can opt in on this, but it's going to cost you all this money, they're probably looking at it saying, it happened once, it was 5 years ago, it's not talked about that much anymore. There's not an outcry or demand from the public for us to have this tracking. I would imagine their accountants are saying, I don't know that you have to do this.
Yeah, not only are there accountants, but we all have short memories, and the other thing is we don't like to think about something unpleasant happening to us. And trust me, the people that are responsible for that airplane being lost and the people that are responsible for any airline that has a loss, they live with that, you know, speaking from experience. That sticks with you for the rest of your life when you are responsible for making a decision like that and you don't do it, and then it does happen to you, it changes your life. It most definitely does. So they have to think of it from that perspective, not just the cost perspective.
When will we know if airlines have opted into something like this? And have airlines since MH370, with the technology that was available then, even though it was more expensive, did any airlines change the way they were operating? Did any airlines say, you know what, we're going to upgrade our tracking so that this could never happen to us?
Yeah, quite a few did. In fact, you know, that article that you read was about Aeron, which is a new company that uses the not Inmarsat.
The Iridium satellites, right?
The Iridium satellites, yeah. And so the Iridium constellation allows a lot more flexibility, and it is a lot more affordable than the Inmarsat can be. But nonetheless, it still comes down to that cost issue.
And so a lot of airlines have, but there's still plenty of airlines that haven't. I imagine it's tougher internationally because not every country's aviation authority is maybe as stringent as the FAA is here to our carriers.
Well, it's actually the opposite in this case. It's none of the U.S. carriers and nor the FAA have decided to go with this system. You know, they,
really?
You know, it's really unfortunate, but I'm really kind of shocked, as a matter of fact. I think there might be one that's thinking about it right now, but as far as the world goes, many more aircraft or airlines in overseas and around the world have joined onto this than have the U.S.
Wow. And is that partly because, I mean, it seems to me, David, like we're flying in a very safe time. We have not had, I know that there was just an accident of a Prime airplane right outside of Houston a couple weeks ago, but we haven't had, knock on wood, a major catastrophe in many years, I want to say, of a domestic airline, correct?
Yeah, that is true. That is true. And, you know, I was speaking with a pilot from Atlas Air, which was that aircraft that had the Amazon Prime crash. And he said that there's still areas where they fly in which they're out of communication for hours at a time as they go across the continents. And even though this is available, they still don't participate in it. And it's really tough to understand or to communicate that. One of the things I was thinking the other day, I had a conversation with someone. They said that the power of the news media, the power of what we're doing right now, communicating this out, is really more powerful than is the regulators. I think if we set up a system where travelers could actually see, I'm flying on an airline that does or does not have this, there's no way for the public to figure that out right now.
Right.
And I think that's the only thing that's really going to allow this to, you know, put the impetus where it needs to be, and let the people that buy the tickets say, hey, I'm going to select the airline who spent the extra 20 cents a ticket, even though it's 20 cents more, whatever it is, because I'm not going to fly on those that don't have it. And I think that's the only next step that I think would actually, you know, force, if you will, the air carriers to start using this system.
Well, I guess the problem is, I would imagine, David, that most Americans fly mostly only domestically, and they would think, well, this would never happen to a domestic flight. Could this happen if I was flying Chicago to L.A. or Chicago to Orlando? Would it be possible within the United States for this to happen? I would imagine the coverage is too good that a plane wouldn't disappear off the radar for that long of time.
Yeah, that's true, and it really isn't a problem within the United States because of the fact that the ELT, the emergency locator transmitters, it's really something that is an issue over large bodies of water. So unless you're, you know, flying from, I don't know, maybe in Alaska to Hawaii, something like that, you know. So that's where there might be a challenge. But other than that, the emergency locator transmitter, when an airplane crashes on land, it's located almost immediately.
Yeah, and so I would imagine that for us to really get the domestic carriers to push this, there would have to be another disappearance, something that had it top of mind for people again. Because I think right now, if you said to people, oh, the airline should really have this, I don't know if there'd be, you know, you and I like talking about MH370, and I think people are very curious about it, but it's not something that people are worried about or thinking about right now. I think people are more worried about, you know, having to take their belt off or how long the TSA line is going to be when they get to the airport.
Yeah, and it's really has most to do with the price of ticket. You know, people have the ability now to choose the cheapest ticket, and they do. You know, it's just been proven over and over again that people don't take the time to look at the safety record, and this goes beyond just, you know, aircraft tracking. It goes into the culture of the airline, and is the airline taking the necessary safety precautions? So the FAA sets only the minimum standard for safety. Isn't that kind of scary if you think about it?
Yeah.
They're just setting the minimum. So we're all flying around on these airplanes, putting our lives in the hands of people whose regulatory minimum is met.
Well,
where's the regulatory maximum? I want to fly on the airline as a regulatory maximum, right?
Well, you know, I just had to fly to a conference a couple of weeks ago, and I was flying on United, and when we were on the way there, they had three different mechanical issues. They finally had us deboard the plane, and they had another one, which kind of freaked me out a little bit. I was saying to the people I was flying with, I'm like, well, we got to find another flight later in the day, blah, blah, blah. And somebody I was flying with, she's like, well, they'll probably get another plane out of the hangar. And, you know, just, I'm like, they don't have planes just sitting around, you know, in the hangar. I know we're in O'Hare and this is United's hub, but there's no way. And they, you know, like, we're going to get another plane out of the hangar. They literally pulled another 757 up and we got into it. And I was like, all right, well, this is weird, but okay. I'm glad you had a spare, but I'm thinking there's a reason why it's in the hangar though. And that makes me nervous that, you know, why'd you just pull this one out? But then on the way home,
yeah, you get this vision of somebody walking through the hangar saying, "Hey, get this plane ready. We need it right now."
Totally,
put it all together.
I was laughing. I was like, "Well, if this plane pulls up with like the old United logo on it, I'm going to be real nervous about this. Like they had this thing mothballed and just yanked it out." Like, yeah, this one's, if it smells a little musty, don't worry about that. We haven't flown this one in about four years, but it'll be good.
Yeah, it was the hangar over at Davis Monthan where the museums are.
Yeah, they pulled it out of the Museum of Science and Industry. It was hanging in the balcony, but we pull it out when we need it. But on the on the flight back from Las Vegas, we're waiting, and he comes on. He's like, "We got the indicator light on. We got to shut down the engine, start them back up, clear that out, and then we'll be good to go." And I'm thinking, is this just like my used car that like lights flash on and off at times? You know, it's it does that. You just got to turn it off, turn it on again, then it works fine. It makes me nervous that he's being that. I'm glad he's being honest about it, and it's his life too. But some of those things, you're like, boy, what are we really just the check engine light? No, that's cool. It just comes on and off. So you do wonder about, you know, what are they going through? And but we've been in such a safe time that I guess, you know, I think we get lulled into just a sense of safety. And like you said, it's not going to happen to us. It's a one in a billion chance and all of these things. And airline travel's been overall so good for Americans for the last 5 or 10 years that we don't really think about it too much. Do you think we should be thinking more? Are you, when you're traveling domestically, are you thinking a little more about the safety, and are there things that make you nervous as a flyer today, David?
Well, the thing that makes me most nervous about flying is that the people that are the passengers don't realize that they are actually part of the safety system. So, you know, when there's something going on in the airplane, someone needs to say something about that's going on. But, and that can be security. That can be something going on in the airplane that needs to be told to the pilot or to the flight attendant. You know, observing what's going on around you is just as every bit as important as the mechanic that twisted the wrenches on the airplane. So we get, like you said, this false sense of security, but I call it the atrophy of vigilance. It's the routine. You have a routine and you continually do it over and over and over and over again. And then what that does is it creates a blind spot in your mind where when there is an anomaly that happens, you don't react to it. You don't see it as an anomaly. You've kind of lulled into this. We get onto an airplane and we just look at our phones or we, you know, read a magazine or turn on the movie, but we're not aware of the fact that we're there because we really don't want to know that we're flying through the air at almost the speed of sound in a metal tube that's pressurized and full of rocket fuel. You know, that's
well,
not really the way
like
you want
that,
to
that, David, you're right. I don't want to think about that at all. Jeez. You know, we're in a metal tube right now. It's full of rocket fuel. If we hit something up here, we're all going to die. Well, thank you. This is why I put on the headphones and don't talk to the person next to me. Please don't tell me those things. That is not how we want to think about that. You're right. And so, so you're, that's interesting. Cause I thought you'd be like, well, people aren't paying attention to the safety information. But you think people should be paying more attention to just the general things that are going on actually while we're in the air. And maybe there is not going to be enough awareness if something's happening that somebody on the flight should know about.
Well, that's part of it. You know, there's been several flights or accidents that I investigated that could have been prevented. There was one that was prevented, I remember, where there was some smoke coming out. It looked like steam, but it was coming out. It was a 737 out of Hawaii, And there was some steam that was coming out above the aircraft, right where you put your luggage in the overhead. And it went on for quite a while before anybody said anything. And finally, somebody just, you know, they were trying to get the flight attendants to, you know, there was a seatbelt light was on, nobody get up. And this guy finally says, "I'm getting up." He gets up, and he walks up, and he starts knocking on the front door and grabs the flight attendant and says, "There's something going on back there. There's smoke coming out." And they kept telling him, "No, it's just steam. There's some, you know, the humidity causes blah, blah, blah." They had this big explanation for it. He goes, "No, there's smoke back there. You got to get this thing care of." And sure enough, there was one of those ballasts on the lights that had turned on, and it had shorted out, and it caused a fire on there. And luckily, they were able to put that out just before it landed. They got everybody off the airplane, and then the aircraft literally burned to the ground.
Really?
But everyone got out safely. There was some smoke inhalation issues, but had someone not said something and just went back and sat down like they told him to, that flight would not have been able to make it to the ground in time. So there's things like that. That's one example. There's many others as well. But if everybody just does what they do and not stay vigilant and look around, I mean, you really are in a precarious situation. And
yeah,
you can save lives if you're aware.
You know, it's interesting because I have been on flights before where as it's warming up, I have seen I guess moisture, or not steam, because it's more of a condensation type thing. But I have seen that with the vents and things like that. And so I could see where you'd be like, "Oh, that's just, you know, it's hot, it's cold, it's whatever it is." And you don't want to be the person, you know, crying wolf. So I think it is tough for people. But I imagine you'd rather somebody be embarrassed that they reported something that was not a big deal than just keep their mouth shut because they didn't want to be embarrassed, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's part of it.
312-981-7200 is the number. David, I have to take a break. I have to get to the news. Are you willing to stick around just a little bit more? Because I would like to get the latest from you on MH370 and what you think is going on and where you think this is headed. And if you and I will be having this conversation another 5 years from now. Can you hang on with us for a couple more minutes?
I'd be happy to.
Excellent. Hold on 1 second. David Soucy, the book is Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. Why it disappeared, and why it's only a matter of time before this happens again. We'll talk to him a little bit more about whether or not that's still an appropriate title for the book. You can check him out at whyplanescrash.com. We've got news coming up from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom with Roger Badish after this on 720 WGN. Matt Bubal here with you on 720 WGN. It's 2:06 a.m. We're live in the Allstate Skyline Studios. Our friend David Soucy is still on the phone with us, kind enough to hang on his book. David, the book is still available in paperback, I'm sure, right?
Yes, it is.
The book is Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, Why It Disappeared, Why It's Only a Matter of Time Before This Happens Again. Now, luckily, here we are 5 years later. It has not happened again, but the threat is still there. That's still a concern, you would say, David, that on an international flight, a plane could disappear in the same way if I guess, all factors lined up in the way they did for MH370. Is that right?
Yep, on particular airlines. Now, the ratio of airplanes now that is being tracked compared to what it was 5 years ago, as of next week, will be much more. So the chance of it happening will be reduced significantly due to the advancements in technology.
I was going to ask you domestically, you were saying that, you know, we kind of need to put pressure on. And I'm wondering, with the current administration, they're very much against new regulations and trying to, you know, make things easier on businesses. Is that part of it? Is it just not likely that in today's climate for business that they're likely to add more regulations? Or are American airlines, our domestic carriers, I should say, are not likely to be forced into something like this where they'd have to spend more money for extra coverage, when I would imagine that they would say, "Hey, it's not happened here in America. It's unlikely to happen. They don't need this extra coverage."
Yeah, that's part of it, but it really goes back way back in the day to 1978 when they deregulated the airlines. Prior to 78, if a safety inspector saw that there was a safety risk, then he could take that up to his boss and say, "Hey, there's a safety risk here." They could force the airlines to do it pretty easily, because if it increased their cost, that cost could be passed on to the flying public, because it would they could mandate, they actually controlled the price of the tickets before that time.
Yeah.
Now, of course, they don't, so it's a free market system. So when you have a safety recommendation that goes forward, you actually have to write, and I, as a safety inspector, I did this quite often, when I'd see a safety recommendation, something that would improve safety, I had to write up a whole piece about what's the cost impact, what's the impact on the business, what's going to happen. You know, it turned me into a bean counter instead of a safety guy.
Well, and it's been, I would guess you would say deregulation has been great for the flying public, even if it hasn't been the best for safety, right?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, you know, that pressure, you know, the competitive pressure actually does help and work because of the fact that at this point, no airline would want to have an accident on their record and have to justify or rationalize why they didn't upgrade their safety gear the way they were supposed to. So it's a different kind of pressure. It's not a controlled government thing anymore, which in my mind is a really good thing. Free market does drive prices down and improves quality. It really does, and just because it leaves it to the consumer to drive that.
And our domestic airlines seem to have a lot of newer aircraft. There have been a lot of airplane orders in the last 10 and 15 years, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, the 767 used to be the spine or the backbone of the American flying public, and now it's retired. I don't think there's anyone that flies them other than cargo now.
And the same thing with the 747. That's kind of sad for me. I never got to fly in a 747, but none of our domestic carriers are still flying a 747, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I got to fly in them quite a lot in my travels because there was a route that I used to take to London quite often that used a 747, and you really missed an experience. The flying fortress that it was is just really quite an experience.
Yeah, I'll bet. All right, so let's talk about MH370 a little bit. So it's been 5 years. There was an intense international search for it for a couple of years, and I imagine hundreds of millions of dollars. That has officially been shut down now, right? Is there any official search going on at all for the plane anymore?
No, there isn't now. There was an independent search that went on, and they agreed to pay this company, I think it was $60 million if they found it. The Malaysian government had kind of a bounty out for that, but unfortunately they didn't come up with anything, and that was the highest technology available for the search, and they searched as much as they could. It was kind of disenchanting for me or disappointing for me that they haven't come up with something, because all the math, everything that went into determining where the search area should be, I think we're still accurate on that. I think it really is still in that area. It's just that it's unbelievably massive when you think about the size of that search area. It's just unfathomable, really.
Now, some debris has washed up on shore that is believed to be from MH370, but very little overall. And I think once a little bit came to shore, we thought, well, there will undoubtedly be more. Do you think that for sure what has been found is from MH370? And why, then, have we not found more?
Most definitely it is from MH370. It's, paramount evidence. There's nothing that says that it wouldn't be from MH370, especially the flap and the ailerons and things that they've found. What's still in question is how it went into the water. So we do know that it did crash into the water. What we don't know is, was it a controlled landing, which would indicate that perhaps someone was at the controls, or was it a stall that then the aircraft spiraled into the water? Those are the two questions that are still left unanswered. In my mind, looking at the pieces that I've studied, and I haven't actually had one in my hand, but in looking at the evidence that I've seen about those pieces, it appears to me that these pieces came off the airplane in flight. If they had come off the airplane by hitting the water, they would be in much different condition than what they are. So it appears to me that, for example, the flaperon, which is the piece that comes down when you come in to land, that piece had been torn off the aircraft because the hinges were broken on it. The side, there's mounted on the sides, but the leading edge of that piece wasn't damaged. So if it's not damaged, that means that it wasn't on the airplane when it hit the water or when it broke off, because it would have come forward and hit the wing, which it didn't. So there's some evidence you can get from that. You can't really be conclusive about what happened, so we just we just keep getting little pieces of the puzzle.
You can check him out at whyplanescrash.com. We've got news coming up from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom with Roger Badish after this on 720 WGN.